This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
George, 100.7 FM, Corvallis in Albany. The time is 6:02. Coming up next is Telecom Wawa.
KBOO is proud to sponsor two special Black History events at Portland State University on Thursday, February 21st, featuring East Coast MC, educator, and community organizer Hassan Salam. First is a multimedia presentation on the history of Black music titled From Spiritual to Hip Hop. This will take place at noon at the Smith Memorial Union on the second floor. The second event is a hip hop show with local progressive artists Sirens Echo, and March 4th. This will happen at 7 p.m. at the Food for Thought Cafe in the basement of Smith Memorial Union. That's two special events with Hassan Salam in celebration of Black History Month on Thursday, February 21st at Portland State University. More information can be found at kboo.fm/Hassan2013.
You are listening to Tillicum Wawa, Voices of the People, with Eugene, Chesley, Samantha, Mike, and Lewis. Drew a blank on your name for a second, Lewis, sorry. And we will be having Dr. Tom Ball on to talk about his recent, basically soon-to-be termination from the University of Oregon as Vice President of the Native American Studies and the issues that surround that and the petition that we have out in order to try to save that position. So stay tuned.
Thank you.
That song was The Tree People Speak by Burning Sky from their CD Enter the Earth, and we play that for the trees that are about to be cut down to make in Pier Park to make a bridge. And we have on the phone with us Dr. Tom Ball. Are you there?
Yes.
Excellent.
Hi, everyone. This is Mike, and I want to thank all the cable listeners for listening. Tonight, we're pleased and honored to have as our guest Dr. Tom Ball, a member of the Klamath Tribe, and who was Klamath Modoc, and at one time was the chairman of the tribe. He graduated from Jefferson High School in Portland, attended Portland State University upon graduation. From there, went to the U of O for his PhD. He also attended Oregon State University for his undergraduate degree. Dr. Ball has been involved in helping the people his entire career. I was fortunate and lucky to have met and worked for him 10 years ago on an Indian Family Wellness Project grant. And until this past December, he was the Vice President of the Native American Program at the University of Oregon. And Dr. Ball, along with Carla Gray, Vice President of the African American Studies, and Emilio Hernandez, the Latino Vice President of Latino Studies, were replaced, or should I say blindsided, by the new Vice President for Equity and Inclusion.
Can you tell us, Tom, what happened with this particular issue?
Sure. I'll give you a little background first. Back in 2004, I went to university to work at the Sopsequatha Indian Teacher Program after the students from that program led protests at the University of Oregon because there's a lack of diversity in their classes and in the University of Oregon in general. And they protested, and I went to work in the Sopsequatha program, and about that same time they were creating, as a result of that that protest and a protest in 1999 for the same thing, and a lawsuit by a black professor, Joe Wade, created the Office of Institutional Equity and Diversity. And as one of those positions, they created a vice president and vice provost at that time for equity and diversity and equity. And they hired three assistant vice provosts. Mike mentioned, Dr. Carla Gary, an African-American, Dr. Emilio Hernandez, Latino, and myself, as Native American. They hired those three positions to work within that program. And we worked there. The faculty, senate, and President Frohnmayer at that time said that there will be a diversity plan and that this office would develop it. And so we developed a template or a way to work with the individual units and colleges on the campus to prepare their own diversity plans. And that's what the AVPs were doing. We're working on those plans with the individual units, and we helped them provide technical assistance when needed to help them through that process. Then in, I think it was June of last year, the vice president or vice president, Charles Martinez, resigned, and they hired a new vice president. And she came in and had a new direction, which the university is certainly has a right to do. She has a new model, something called the distributive model for equity and inclusion. And as part of that, reorganize the office and let those three positions go, Dr. Gary and Dr. Hernandez and myself.
What's the reasoning behind What's her reasoning behind letting you three go, considering your positions are very important to these programs?
Right on.
You know, all we've been told is that it's reorganization. that the distributive model that she is talking about, she says that that's everybody's business on campus, which it is, diversity. But she said she was going away from an ethnic-based where we work directly with our communities. I worked in the Native community, Dr. Gary in the African-American community, and Dr. Hernandez in the Latino community. So she said she's doing going away from that model, which was, in her eyes, ethnic-based, and going to a distributive model. That's the only thing that we've been told.
What's the difference between the ethnic-based and the distributive model?
Thank you.
The according to her, according to things that she's published, the difference is, as far as I can tell, and this has never been explained to any of us, she's never sat down and told us or explained to us or showed us what her plan or vision is, which we've asked for several times. The ethnic model, we worked in our communities and with our students. For instance, my job description had me working 100% of the time, kind of as a liaison with the tribes in the university, working with the students, developing Native strategies and initiatives on campus, working faculty development, recruitment and retention, and things like that. So as far as I can tell, her model says that that should be the business of everybody on campus.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Dr. Ball. This is Shesley, one of the hosts of Tillicum Wawa. And I'm wondering if what you have seen in terms of enrollment of Native American students and completion of degrees since you've been in your position, do you feel like there has been a benefit to garnering more U of O graduates since you've been in position?
Well, the University of Oregon, I saw a report the other day of the other OES institutions has the highest rate of completion by Native Americans, mm-hmm. but our numbers are going down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're the only ones that are going down as far as enrollment. The completion rates, our students seem to be doing better than the other students at other OES schools, but it's still mm-hmm. not. I think it was like 63% or something. I don't want to say exactly because I don't have the report in front of me, but it was a little bit higher than Oregon State and Portland State.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering if the local Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and Siletz, or possibly other tribes in the state or out of state, have financially supported you being in that position. Has money been paid to U of O to have you as a liaison there?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm paid by the state, by the University of Oregon, by their funds.
Okay.
The tribes have contributed quite heavily to the University of Oregon and programs there.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, they paid for roughly a third of the longhouse when that was built. They put money forward for a law school, a Native law school chair, and they funded other things. The Calcrit tribe, every time the Ducks score a touchdown, gives $777 to the athletic department.
$770.
Yeah.
Any reason for that number?
777, I guess.
Okay.
But that money doesn't come to our students.
That goes to the university.
Yeah. And, you know, that could fund our programs by itself.
Have you had any input from the tribes or any comment on this really sudden blindsiding of you being removed from your position?
The Grand Round Tribe and the Umatilla Tribe, I know, have sent letters to President Godfredson in support of this position, in support of me, and asking why the tribes weren't consulted on this, since they have a President's Native American Advisory Board that was set up by President Frohnmeyer to kind of act as government-to-government relations, although it's not directly government-to-government relations. And the tribes weren't consulted, and this, you know, severely impacts them and their students. Removal of this position because of all the initiatives and things that we were working on, and you know, there's no plan or person in place that they're talking about who will carry these out, at least as far as I know.
Well, she made a public statement that she had talked to all of you about this, and apparently that was not true, because none of you have talked to her about all this.
We asked for a retreat when she came, mm-hmm. and we were told there would be one that never happened. We've asked, like I said, for what her vision is and what her plan looks like, and we've never been given anything. We've never seen it.
That's just a shame that somebody can come in there and do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many minorities is U of O going to lose because they have no leaders of their ethnic communities?
That's the question that people mm-hmm. should be asking Dr. Asenso and President Godfredson.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they should absolutely be asking that question.
Do they have email addresses people can contact them through?
I don't know what they are, but you can Google or whatever, and it's Dr. Yvette Alex Asenso and Michael Godfredson is the president.
Excellent. So all you listeners out there, Google your and find their emails and make your protest to them.
Yes, and we also have a petition that Mike has some emails for.
Yes, anybody that wants to sign a petition, and we hope that you all will, is feel free to email me at my email, small letters, MIKER, 492004@yahoo.com, and I'll be glad to forward the petition to you.
That's Mike R. 492004@yahoo.com. Excellent.
Great.
Another thing I wanted to bring up while we're on the subject of email addresses is you can also email Representative Peter DeFazio, which I have done so, by small letters again, defazio.house.org. And when his site comes up on the website, on the right-hand corner, there's a little tab that says email me, and you click on that, and it brings it up, and you can send Representative DeFazio an email. And Samantha worked for DeFazio, and she knows that he'll try and help us.
He's very sensitive to all the issues in this area, in the whole state, and he's right on it. And if you want to email him or call him, he will definitely, you will see results within a couple of weeks, I'll tell you.
I have a quote from the Register Guard, December 28th, under the article, Changes to U of O's Diversity Office Blasted. It's a quote from Dr. Alex Asenso?
Asenso,
She says, quote, accountability for these issues is distributed throughout the university rather than being the sole responsibility of one person or an individual, as indeed was the case previously. She went on further to say, I hope to engage faculty and staff to embrace diversity throughout the hiring process, from writing of job descriptions to placement of advertisements, interviewing, and actively recruiting diverse candidates. But she doesn't seem to address the issues of the unique perspective coming from the Latino communities, the Native American communities, and the African American communities, the challenges that those kids might be facing to enter university, and the different funding sources that might be available.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just such a happy little wide brushstroke that she's painted with. And I really feel like there will be more people than only you and the other two who were displaced who are going to suffer from these changes.
Absolutely. I think it's going to affect all of the natives in the whole state.
Well, the that statement, if you just start picking that apart, the putting this in a historical context, that distributive model is nothing new. This is really the fifth iteration of that at the University of Oregon. And back in the late 60s, Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, that was the first time that minority students first started arriving on campus in big numbers. And at University of Oregon and other campuses, they weren't, didn't really know what to do with us. And and there was a lot of student protest. There was students started their own student unions. That's where they came from. That's when they started. And the universities were really scrambling to try and support the minority students. They really didn't know what to do with them. So, for instance, at University of Oregon in, I think it was 1970, the Native students formed and they started their NASU, their Indian Club, and something called NAP, called Native American Programs. And they, what they wanted was their own advisor, somebody to work with them, because they were basically just advising themselves as students, don't take this class, it's too hard, take this one, it's easier, and that kind of thing. And they had created an office for all minorities, and I can't remember, student support or something like that. But the Indian students were didn't really go to that. This is the first time that Indians and blacks and Latinos really had been together, mm-hmm. and didn't really know much about each other. And the Indian students weren't feeling supported, or they didn't think their cultural needs were met. And so they asked for their own advisor. They actually wrote a grant and got it, received it, and started their own program. But a couple years, about a year or two later, they consolidated all the programs. Mm. And what always happens is the Native students are the smallest number, and they just, you know, eventually become invisible. And the other students don't like that. There's a student protest, and they started the whole cycle over again. And this has happened, this is the fifth time now at the University of Oregon. So that distributive model, where it's everybody's business, doesn't work. You know, if it's if everybody's responsible, nobody's responsible.
Mm-hmm.
This is what happens.
That's right. And each group needs different, has different needs,
right,
and different desires of what they want to learn and support, and each culture has their own support system, and you just can't eliminate that and expect people to be on your football team or your basketball team or go to your school at all.
Absolutely.
And if you're just tuning in to KBOO and listening, you're listening to Tillicum Wawa, where we are talking to Dr. Tom Ball, who was, to put it gently, demoted from his University of Oregon position. And we're talking about the consequences that may take place as a result. Can you talk about the protest that took place last month, Dr. Ball? About this change?
Sure. Well, on November 29th, we were given notice that our contracts were... actually, what's happened is our contracts haven't been renewed. And so on November 29th, we were called in and given papers to sign. We had 4 days to sign them, and two of those being a weekend. And We're basically told we're being, our positions aren't being, our contracts won't be renewed. And so I work real closely with the Native student organization, NASU. I have two nieces in there, and we just, through connections, know most of the students in there and their families. And so we work real closely with them. And so they were, when we told them, and it's in my job description that I'm supposed to be working with those students, and so I saw that as part of my job description to let them know that, because it would affect them. And so they were basically outraged. They wanted to do something right away, as did other people on campus, some other people. And so they wrote a letter to the president, and they outlined three or four things, how they felt it was going to affect them, and that they felt that this position and the other two positions should be reinstated. And they really didn't get a response, and so they protested. They got together the first day of class on winter term, and they met in the EMU and had speakers and sang songs, and with drums and song, they marched on the campus, or on Johnson Hall, the administration where the president is and where Dr. Ascenso is. When they got there, there was, president, of course, wouldn't come out, or Dr. Ascenso, and they had two people there at the top of the stairs, just like the big house, and, standing there like overseers. And
well, there was a large crowd, wasn't there?
There, it was a pretty good turnout, the first day of class. So nobody really, other students really didn't know about it, but the Black Student Union and MECHA, the Latino Student Organization, were both present to support the Native students. And there was community people and the LGBTQ students, some of them were also there. So it was a good turnout, and I was real proud of them.
I heard that you didn't speak, but that you had your drum with you and let it speak. Is this the same protest?
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't speak. It was a student protest, not my protest. Mm-hmm. And
I thought that was great that you let your drum do the talking.
Yeah.
There's a lot of power in that.
And my feet.
And your feet. And all those prayers and the drums.
Yeah. And it was pretty powerful. They asked some really good questions of the two people that came out to address them or take their concerns.
Another point I wanted to bring up to you is during the course of the year, Dr. Ball and his wife Allison both attend numerous functions, powwows, and during these functions they are recruiting. So this is not just a University of Oregon local issue. This affects, you know, the Northwest, basically, the Native educational, you know, the systems and programs throughout the Northwest. Because they don't just recruit locally. It's, you know, far-ranging recruitment.
Well, that's a good point, Mike, and I think that's true for all our communities. In working in our minority communities, it's all about relationship and relationship building. And Allison and I have been building that relationship through our research projects and through attending powwows and our family that's all through the Northwest. And we've been careful to try and build that relationship. And when we go and visit places, when we recruit, we try and take faculty and staff and students and administrators to go and meet with the tribes so they can see where they're at, who they are, what their interests are for themselves. And so that relationship that's been being built, you know, they're just throwing that out the door.
They certainly are.
And that's a shame. You know, shame on University of Oregon, shame on the president, and shame on Dr. Ascenso
right on,
for
shame.
Not talking to the tribes beforehand.
So what kind of experience does Dr. Yvette Alex Asenso have in this arena?
You know,
she read a book.
You know, her experience hasn't been in diversity work. She's a political scientist, really top-notch academic. She's written books, published articles, and she's recognized for her work in political science. At Indiana, she was also asked to come in and take over an office that dealt with women's programs on campus. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, that's her background.
Did she do a distributive model with the women's program?
You know, you'd have to ask Dr. Asenso.
Any guy on campus can help you with that.
Yeah.
Did these women wear feathers?
How did she get this position, not having any experience in the field of diversity? I could see her getting a political science position, but how did she get this position, and how does the university allow her to make these changes when she doesn't seem to have the knowledge or any form of a plan?
Well, I can speak to the hiring process at University of Oregon. It was a national search. They had a screening committee, a large hiring committee that was somewhat diverse. And I had asked to have a member of the tribes, Oregon tribes, be on that committee, mm-hmm. but was told it was too late and the committee was put together. But there were Indian representation on there, on the committee. And so they went through the regular process. People applied. They screened the applicants. They narrowed them down, and they started bringing candidates to campus. And she was, I think, one, two, three, four, that came to campus and actually made campus visits and did job talks, presentations on her vision. And after that, community people were able to input. People had a way to input, give their input after her presentations, and the committee selected her. I can't say what went on in the committee. I wasn't a part of it, but she was selected out of those four. So that's how she came to campus, and I'm not sure, I can't tell you what went on in those talks with the committee because I wasn't a part of that.
What were they doing the national search for?
For that vice president position, vice president for...
For everybody?
Yeah.
And what made them think that that would be a... Do you have any idea what made them think that that would be a better idea?
No. I have. That's something you'd have to ask her or whoever's telling her or the president. Or again, you'd have to direct those to them.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
To tell you the truth, I don't know. Okay. I've never had a conversation with her about the distributed model in depth, where she actually talks about the vision, who's going to be responsible for this and that, how long it's going to take. And that's the things that we were doing with our diversity plans that we were working on.
Right.
They had those plans had to have goals and activities. They had to have a diversity mission and vision, and mm-hmm. why it was important to their unit. And then they had to have goals and activities to achieve diversity within their units. And some of them really made fantastic progress. One of the units that I work with, their first year, said this. Just going through this process has changed the way we do business and the way that we look at diversity. Mm-hmm. And that was huge. And I think that's the other thing, I think, is all that work, good work, that people on campus did for 5 years, that's just thrown out the window, too. And there were some really good best practices that came out of that work.
So let me summarize here, if I can. They hire this woman who is... a political activist, or a political scientist,
yeah.
Yvette Alex Asenso, uh-huh. for a position in diversity, which she doesn't really have experience on.
Now, I don't want to say that. I'm not sure. Okay. What I do know is her academic background and what she did at Indiana with the women's programs.
And so we know that she's a good academic, but we don't know her experience in diversity.
Right.
She's changing the model that's been working to a distributive model that there is no real clear plan for, and she hasn't worked with you or the other two professors.
Right.
And it's obviously affecting the students already because they're protesting and they're unhappy about this.
And our communities are unhappy.
Yeah. And what is the leadership of the university saying about this? Are they standing behind her, or are they looking into the issue deeper?
They're absolutely standing behind her.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
And the diversity plans that we were working on, while a lot of good work was going on, there were problems with it, and we recognized those problems. And one of them was involvement of faculty and faculty issues. And what really led to all this, I believe, in my mind, was a group of faculty got together and sent a letter or a petition to President LaRiviere at the time with concerns about faculty issues not being met in this diversity plan process. And we advised Dr. Martinez that he should put together a faculty committee so we could address this because it's a serious issue. And that never happened for whatever reason. I'm not sure. But I think that's what sparked this whole move. The issues from the faculty. Now, the faculty, the ones that signed that letter, I would really doubt that any of them were on their diversity committees.
Amazing.
Hmm. That's a question that needs to be asked. But
yeah,
they are not, as far as I know. I feel that, in a way, they're responsible for us leaving, and I don't think they're being consulted to a great deal either. And
Well, this is really bugs me, the fact that she's a public servant, she's been paid by the university money, and yet in this article on the 10th of this year, she says that she cannot speak publicly about her personal decisions. She's a public servant. Yeah. I mean, she's like, what has she got to hide?
Yeah.
Something.
I mean, we're paying her salary, the university, you know, public money, and she's like, well, I can't talk about it? I mean, I don't understand that.
Well, you know, that's their canned answer, is they say they can't speak about this because it's a personnel issue. It's not a personnel issue. They are not renewing our contracts.
It's so secret, you don't even get to know.
And if it's a personnel issue like they're talking, then that when we go to look for jobs, people look at that and say, oh, personnel issue.
Yeah.
But it's not a personnel issue.
I'll bet they saved $150,000 a year by doing this.
That's probably what it's all about.
And they're going to lose $150,000 of, you know, tribal money for you know, for this lady's ego, basically.
Is we're all in our 60s.
Oh.
And close to retirement.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense now.
It's always about, I mean, I think it's got to be about the money. There's no other good reason at all.
Yeah, like that old saying
anyone
goes,
can see.
Follow the money.
Well, that, again, you'd have to ask the prisoner. Yeah. And what you'll get is it's reorganization. And
we can't talk about it.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. It really seems like this is a huge step backwards in your minority relations there.
Well, you know, she met with the tribes earlier this week in Salem, and she heard that from several of our tribal leaders, that to not consult the tribes after Oregon was the first state to draft a tribal consultation law, Senate Bill 770. and the work that President Frohnmayer did to set up a Native American advisory board to not be consulted, to be brought to the table after the fact and told this is what you're going to eat at this table, was insulting to the tribes, and they told her that.
Absolutely.
What can our listeners do to help?
Pardon?
What can our listeners do to help?
They can write letters to the president and to, well, yeah, to president, to the president. The
president of the university.
Yeah.
And they can get a hold of me on my email address so I can forward the petition to everyone sign that.
But personal letters, how that affects, you know, if they're alumni, if they have students there, if their tribe's paying money for their students to go to the University of Oregon. Because that's another thing. Each student is worth $120,000 to the University of Oregon. So I saw a report from the University of Oregon the other day that said there's more than 500 Native students. I don't personally believe that, but if there are, that represents $72
million. That's right. And how much are they saving?
How much of that is tribal money, and what are our students getting in return when they're letting me go? Four Indians have left campus in the last 2 years. When my wife and I leave, that'll be four Indians that have worked with Native students that are gone.
Wow. That's a shame to our students.
And my wife and I represent 40% of the Native PhDs on campus.
That's awesome.
Is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with before we let you go here?
Yeah, there is. This really isn't about me, and what I'd like to see in place is a model like they have. She keeps talking about best practices, distributive model, but best practices for Indian or across Indian country is to have my position a direct reporting line to the president or the provost. So it's a special liaison, tribal liaison to the president. And along with that, there's a strong memorandum of agreement between the tribes and the state and the university that spells out rules and responsibilities. It's not just a feel-good memorandum of agreement. It actually spells out rules and responsibilities. And then the other thing they need to have is a tribal consultation policy so this doesn't happen again.
Right on.
And I'd like to see those things in place, and we're working on them, before I leave. I think it'd benefit the university, definitely would benefit our students and tribes and Native faculty to have those things in place. And then I think the any new president or any senior level hire should have that as part of their orientation, that they're introduced to those documents. So that's what I'd like to see in place. That's the best practice in Indian country.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, Tom, I'd really appreciate you being on the show tonight, and know that we support you 100%.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very honored, and I was a student at Portland State when John Talley started that radio show.
You've got to be kidding.
Talley, and sure miss that guy.
Oh, we do too. You know, we did Indian Country for 22 years together.
Yeah. And
I really miss him.
Yeah.
But
I'm really honored to have been asked and to be on this show.
The honor was ours, yeah. Tom.
And, you know, we'd like to have you back on at some point to tell us what's going on in the future sometime soon.
I'd love to, and I'd also like to talk about my research in historical trauma and work in those areas.
Oh, great. Excellent. Great. That would be great.
So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Tom.
Wado.
And you're listening to Tillicumwawa. We were just talking with Tom Ball, a professor down at the University of Oregon, whose position is being eliminated as the Vice President of Native American Studies. And how about a song? You're listening to Tillicum Wawa, Voices of the People, with the whole tribe in the house here. And we just interviewed Tom Ball, and we just listened to the song Blood of the Land. Oh, wait.
Wisdom Keeper
from A Simple Man by Burning Sky.
We got out the Burning Sky CDs tonight because they're just so beautiful.
We would have played a lot more, but...
The interview was good, and we needed to get that information out to show how diversity is sometimes undermined if you don't understand the issues.
And how can one person really run three different cultural departments?
Seems like that just got thrown under the bus.
Yeah. I'm telling you. We're going to have to stop it. Everybody just get online, write the president. It affects the whole state, and just say, this isn't acceptable, and we're not going to accept it. And you're going to lose a lot of students. And just lay it on it.
Yeah.
You know? Because it's true.
I once heard somebody say that Native Americans are not losing their land anymore. That now that everything's settled, we don't lose our land. Everybody here is laughing. We can lose it in other ways besides just sheer acreage, like using it for dumps without any say over what's happening to your land. Being a so-called sovereign nation without having any say over what you can grow on your land. You can ask Alex and Deborah Whiteplume about that one. Mm-hmm. They grew hemp, which had zero THC in it, nearly zero, and they weren't allowed to do that as members of a sovereign state. So Eugene got on the internets today and got some information about Wounded Knee and how that is for sale.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah.
The Wounded Knee site is actually for sale by James, I'm going to probably trash his name, Szyzinski, who owns the property. He doesn't own the burial site. He owns a site where the actual massacre happened, which is just across the street from the burial site. And he wants the tribe, the Oglala Sioux, who are one of the poorest tribal nations in the United States, to pay $3.9 million for property that is estimated at top $10,000.
You know, I was always under the impression that was a national monument.
That's what I thought, too. I was amazed. This was the first that I heard of this.
They really want to bury Indian history.
Yeah, and supposedly... he bought it in 68, and supposedly either during the siege or something, he had buildings on there, a museum, a store, and a few other buildings that were supposedly burned down, but I had never heard of this. I don't doubt that it's true, but I don't know if it happened during that time. He didn't say whether it was the Indians or the feds or all the other groups working with the feds that did this. Or if it happened after the fact. I also found out that people were evacuated from the site from 73 until 1990 when they were allowed to move back on. I didn't know that either. And so
interesting.
If you all want to find out about this, look it up in Google. And I can't remember the website. It's like it's on our... It's on the Tillicum Wawa Facebook page. It's linked on that.
Become friends with Tillicum Wawa.
Yeah, become friends with Tillicum
Ironically, Wawa. We're at the 40th anniversary of the commemoration of the liberation of Wounded Knee, and this is a really good time for it to be re-liberated. So maybe it can go on the auction block and somebody can buy it for $5,000 or $10,000, like Winona LaDuke's White Earth Land Recovery, where they have... a company, and then they use their profits to buy their tribal lands back. That's one way to do it.
That is one way. They have an organization here in Oregon that has a group of people that contribute extra money to buy property and leave it wild.
Yeah, so, and part of the Black Hills just got bought back, so maybe Wounded Knee can get bought back, too.
Who bought those back? The Oglala?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Money was donated. A lot of money was donated.
Wonderful.
And well, I think that's why this guy is asking so much, is so he can get that kind of money, but it's a totally different circumstances.
That's right. That's right.
A lot of activities are planned in the commemoration of the 1973 takeover of Wounded Knee under the title BIA, I'm Not Your Indian or Indian Anymore. Starting next week, there will be different things happening, traditional feasts, concerts, and so on, I think, to raise awareness I would go, if I were you, to look that up, Remember Wounded Knee, 1890 to 1973.
You know, John Talley was there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. We have a button that we got from his memorial that he got at Wounded Knee, and we had John Bravehawk and Miriam over a couple of weeks ago, and he really liked that button.
Oh, yeah.
But in my way, I did not give it to him. Although I have been told that when you are complimented, you must give something to the person who compliments you.
Right.
This weekend at Chamawa in Salem, the oldest or the longest open Indian school, off-reservation boarding school, is a commemorative powwow. It's been going 133 years this year.
Wow.
Has quite a history. So much of it is horrible. And I think the kids who go there now like it. It's a different kind of scene than when my grandfather went there or Eugene's grandmother went there. I was told by my father that my grandfather ran away from there two or three times as a very small child, made it all the way back to Agnes, Oregon.
Wow.
And that the school official stopped coming for him. So, tenacity.
A success story.
You know, things have changed because the friend of mine, Rafael Rosa, was vice president of that college. So things have changed.
Yeah, things have changed. There was a ceremony there a few years back, the wiping of tears ceremony. And I believe there was a secret graveyard there from all of the students who have died. Mm. There was one as recently as 2003. Unfortunately, a young woman, Cindy Sohappy, died there of alcohol poisoning when they put her in a holding cell. And it's a very dangerous condition. They didn't check on her, and she deceased. The family sued the BIA for $24 million and settled for $1.8 million on her wrongful death. And they deserved. There's nothing that can replace that precious child. Mm-mm. But they deserved more than that. So the powwow is this Saturday, the 23rd, noon to what? It's this Saturday. I don't know that it goes on through Sunday. It's the 23rd, and it's 3700 Chamawa Road, Northeast. Oh, I guess it wouldn't be the 23rd. Yeah, 23rd. Yeah. Salem, 97305. You can call 503-399-5721 for more information.
What area code was that?
503-399-5723.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Thank you for listening tonight. We've already killed an hour.
Yeah, and to get the petition, contact Mike Rosemond at mikr492004@yahoo.com. Contact the University of Oregon. Raise as much heck as you possibly can, because it needs to be raised so they will listen. And thank you for listening.
And you can also email DeFazio at defazio.haas.com.
Yeah. And we're going out with Twisted Hair by Robbie Robertson.
Yay.
Thank you for listening to Tilikum Wawa, Voices of the People.
Wada.
This is rock medicine, the talking tree, the singing water. Listen, I am dancing underneath you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is now 7 o'clock. Coming up in this hour is Hard Knock Radio. You stay tuned.
This is Rachel and Justin from Music from the True Vine inviting you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs.
We'll be joined by our fellow Music from the True Vine hosts as the True Vine Ramblers performing a set of traditional bluegrass. Our special guests will be Deanne Nelson and Jim Seafeld.
Other acts include Henry and Moggy doing some down-home ragtime and country, Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends putting the bow to some old-time fiddle tunes, and Retta Christie and her one-night stand band performing Western Swing.
Once in a Boo Moon is on Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church from 7 to 10 p.m.
Doors open at 6 o'clock p.m. Plan on arriving early as ticket prices also include desserts with coffee or tea.
For event and ticket price details, go to kboo.fm/boomoon2013.
Once in a Boo Moon is a benefit for your community radio station, KBOO.
Y'all, it's Aya Sage, a.k.a. Rocky Rivera, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio, news, views, hip-hop.
Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. Been sitting in front of me. You know her, you love her. She's no stranger to our show. The one and only Rocky Rivera, a.k.a. Ice Age, a.k.a. Dynamite MC on the mic, a.k.a. Don't get in her way or she might hurt you. How you doing, Rocky?
I'm doing great. I'm loving all the mafioso aliases over there, but it's great. It's good to be back home. I always say that every time I come back, but this time it's with some new material, some new music, and some new context to challenge the status quo, which is always what I love to do.
You know, for a lot of people that's listening, a little bit of background about yourself. Many people knew you for years as a writer.
Yes.
And the stereotype is that frustrated MCs become writers. Were you a frustrated writer who became an MC?
I think that anybody who's a writer is frustrated. I mean, editorial never gets any love. Authors don't get any love. And I'm just a weird hybrid because I think I was a performer first and then I became a writer thinking I would never be a female MC. You know, I think every female MC has a backup plan. And I've mentioned it before. We don't all just do one thing. And it's because we have this thought in our head that this is not going to last forever. So it's good because it brings a certain perspective to my work that while I'm here, I'm not here to struggle to stay relevant. I'm here to really tell you my message as of right now, and hopefully that's going to lead to some change.
Do you have a backup plan?
yeah, school. Journalism was my first career.